from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll talk with poet Liza Hyatt about her new collection.
I'll get my motor running and get a preview of Steel Ponies at the Eideljorg.
And I'll find out about the Music for All National Festival going on in Indianapolis this weekend. Plus, we'll also have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. In 2006, poet and art therapist Liza Hyatt received a grant from the Indiana Arts Commission. Many of the poems that were created from this time have been collected in her new book, Under My Skin. The collection includes poems that deal with mothering, marriage, sex, divorce, and waiting in line at the grocery store. Travis DiNicola spoke with Liza about her new book.
Let's start with, I'd like to have you read one of the poems in it, one titled A Lesson in Natural History. Then we'll talk about the collection, okay?
Okay, all right. A Lesson in Natural History. Do not be afraid if I still remember you. Little deer have been found, buried, frozen, preserved, inside rifts of soft faults. Neanderthals laid flowers on their dead, and yellow pollen dusts the bones of those graves. Druids gave living people to the bogs, and men dredge them up now, look at their leathered faces, find seed cakes and honey mead in wineskin stomachs. I saved the letter where you folded the mountain daisy. When Vesuvius erupted, it made ash statues of fleeing women and dogs. When you last wrote, you said, I still think of you, historically, that is. Under ice lies a giant mammoth. On its tongue still clings the buttercup it was eating when the world swallowed.
Yeah, you know, there's so many things that I liked about that one. That's why I wanted to ask you to read it. I mean, just the image, of course, of the woolly mammoth with the buttercup is something that I remember from, like, I don't know, a fourth grade science class or something.
Exactly.
You know, but at the same time, to the line about I still think of you historically, that is, that's just so painful.
It is.
It is.
Yeah.
And so many of the works that are in here, I'm guessing are very autobiographical, but that line alone, did you hear that line? Did someone say that to you?
Yeah, that was actually in a letter from an old college boyfriend that had a great knack for getting right in there.
Historically,
historically, yes. And I heard those same things in fourth grade, so all these things came to mind.
And then the flower pressed. I mean, we're all sort of natural historians.
Right, exactly.
So tell me how this all came to be. I know that you received a grant from the Indiana Arts Commission back in 2006, one of their individual artist grants, and that let you do a lot of the work that's collected here. But there's certainly a lot more to the story than that.
Yeah. Well, of course, when you apply for a grant, you apply the year before, mm-hmm. and then they have a panel and discussion and judging and all of that kind of stuff. So when I applied in 2005, I was married, you know, trying to reclaim my writing life after having had a child and mm-hmm. most of my creative energy going toward that. You know, writing during nap time was about all I had then.
Sure.
And by the time the letter arrived from the Arts Commission saying that I'd gotten the grant, I was divorced and I'd moved twice. And I had pretty much decided I was never going to write poetry again. I just didn't have any energy for it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I didn't even expect I was going to get the grant. Mm-hmm. So when it came, the letter came in the mail, and I thought, oh no. mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, okay, even though I feel like I've totally been wiped out, something wants me to keep going. So I kept going.
And... Well, and this is interesting to me because, Liza, in addition to being a poet, you're also an art therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So in a way, it sounds like you were almost kind of, because of the grant, forced into sort of the therapy of writing poems again.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. It's good when you're an art therapist to have experiences in life where you feel like you can't produce anything, and yet somehow the healing comes from sitting down and doing the painful work.
So a lot of your story, the story of raising your daughter, of being a newlywed, of going through the trials of marriage and then divorce, are all sort of chronicled in here.
Mm-hmm.
One that really stood out for me, though, when you were talking about just the time to find time to write poetry, is the one titled Marriage Haiku, and you've got a sort of a preface in there. Tell me a little bit about that, because I found it kind of interesting to think about when you have so little time, at least you can still maybe get a haiku out.
Yeah. In fact, the whole book is dedicated to Indiana poet Anita Spear Smith, who I met in my late 20s when I moved back to Indiana after college, and she was in her 70s, and she had written poetry her whole life, and I would go hang out at the Slippery Noodle for the poetry readings that the Writer Center did, and she would always be the first one up there to read with her Reeboks and her little skirt on and her bent, you know, osteoporosis back, and... And somewhere during that time, as she encouraged me to write, she said that, you know, when she was a mother raising young children, there were days when she couldn't write at all. And so she developed a practice of writing haikus. And I thought to myself, well, I'm above all that. Nothing will stop me from writing. And so, you know, years later, there I was. And I thought of her, and I said, okay, time to start writing those haikus.
Yeah. So, it sounds like they kept you going for a little while.
Yeah, it did. It very much did.
So there's a collection of a number of haikus in here. If you want to maybe pick one or two to read, there's some great, very short pieces.
I thought. And those were written kind of all around the fall after 2011 and all 2000, the 9/11 stuff. And let's see. How about leaving home by choice, midlife, need to change, shed lies, simplify, find love, and poems in place of love, word shanties for homeless need, paper longing to be held, or shopping for school shoes, my only child, six too soon, I grieve as she grows.
That one's really sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one thing I've learned as a mother, that every change involves grief. So there's always something I'm grieving about, losing as my daughter goes through stages in life.
Losing and celebrating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the poem to me then in some ways really stood out as actually kind of one of the most moving, I thought, is the shortest one in the book. It's not even long enough to be a haiku.
Uh-huh.
And it's the one titled The Two Things Walls Say When You Are Married. could you read that one? I mean, it's such a short one. But in some ways, it also really, I thought, sums up a lot of what's happening with so many of the other poems in the book.
Yeah. The title is definitely longer than the poem itself. So The Two Things Walls Say When You Are Married. One, build us up. Two, tear us down. So,
walls are not normally known for, you know, being verbose, but
no. I think I wrote that as just a, you know, kind of a, I was frustrated and I just scribbled it on a piece of paper and I didn't even think of it as a poem until much later. And it just, it's like, well, heck yeah, that's all that needs to be said.
So you did start writing poetry again, and in part because of the grant, and now it's you know 2012, and the book has just come out, Under My Skin. This has been a long process for you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some of the poems, like the one I read, the natural history one, was written before I even met my now ex-husband. You know,
okay.
So there's some poems that are like 25 years old in
there.
I got the grant in 2006. It's obviously 6 years later that the book is now finally published. I think that's just the nature of of poetry is you have it takes a long time to hear actually what the words are trying to say. So
is revising, editing, going back to something, letting it sit for a while, is that part of your process?
A lot of patience. Like the one, the real short one about walls, I blew that off as not even something valid. And then, you know, it's kind of like being an archaeologist. You put your writing away and then you take it out and dust it off and look at it. And sometimes I don't even remember what I was trying to say. And that might even be better because the hidden...
A different state of mind that maybe you couldn't even get to now.
Right.
But you were fortunate enough to sort of record it in a manner then.
Yes, exactly. Mm. Yes. Mm. And one of the people that helped me on the book is poet Fran Quinn. Who I took several poems to him that I had written for my ex-husband. And he said, okay, now take them out and make them more honest. You know, put the anger in them, and that he was right that I needed to be writing for myself and not somebody
else,
and I needed to put the real. There's a lot in those poems, and one of my goals in this book was to be absolutely honest about relationships, in my life, and I think in women's lives or people's lives. And honesty was really important for that.
Let me ask you to read a poem that you would like to read. I've asked you to read a couple that I wanted to share, but what's a poem that you would like to share with our listeners?
Okay. I think I'll pick the last poem in the book, which is called I Have Been Given. There's other poems in the book. I mean, the book starts out with a poem called Give Me, and then there's a poem, What I Can Give, and the last one is I Have Been Given. I think that shows an evolution of, you know, a woman's sense of giving and needing and all of that.
This one has some great images in it.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed. Yeah.
So yeah, this is what I have been given. A box of watercolors. Morning on a screen porch. A table and shelves built by my father. A child's drawing of the sun. My mother's old coat. A self made supple by change. A ghostly ultrasound grown into a thriving child. An empty glass jar. An open spigot that fills the jar. Books that crowd the shelves. Creation, love, trickster stories filling the books. A mirror in which to see the hero's thousand faces. Apollo's view of Earth in space, the pomegranate generosity of grief, new white paper on the well-used table, the creek song shade of cottonwood, mint and strawberries from the garden, health after a long illness, a dream that God is living paint, a thick brush filled with green.
Beautiful images.
Yeah.
And really just and such a nice way to end this collection, because it does end on such sort of a note of gratitude and optimism.
And being able to look back on my life as a whole and see somehow it's all meant to happen and all that I've been given along the way, you know, as a single woman, divorced, making a living as an art therapist and a poet. You know, I'm not rolling in the money, but I feel like I've been given so much. So,
Liza, you've got a reading coming up at Book Mamas?
Saturday the 17th at 2 o'clock. And I'll be there with Norbert Kraft, who's former Poet Laureate of Indiana.
So, excellent. Great. Yeah. And then you've got some other coming up in the future as well. I know that if people go to the website, and that is lizahyatt.wordpress.com, they can get more information about upcoming readings as well.
Yep. Yeah, that's good.
Very good. Liza, thanks so much for coming into Art of the Matter today.
Thank you, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with poet Liza Hyatt. Her new book is titled Under My Skin. The book is available on Amazon and at local bookstores. You can get more information at lizahyatt.wordpress.com. LizaHyatt.wordpress.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
It is time to get your motor running, because motorcycles, symbols of adventure, freedom, individualism, and even danger, have roared into the Idlejorg in an exhibit called Steel Ponies. Why? Sharon Gamble invited curator White Wolf James to tell us how motorcycles are connected to concepts of the American West.
I'm from Northern California. I'm from Mendocino County. My home is 2 hours north of San Francisco. Mendocino County, I'm a Pomo Indian from that area, and I worked at the Grace Hudson Museum in Ukiah, California for many years.
So this was a little bit of a change of scenery, literally.
Yes, quite a big change. I had lived in Omaha, Nebraska when I was in the Air Force, but that was back in the 70s.
And what do you think of the Midwest so far?
You know, Indianapolis is a really beautiful city, and people are really genuine and friendly out here that I've found, and it's no different than any other modern city. It's just getting used to the weather. Of course, where I come from, there's hardly any snow and no humidity, so that's been a little bit to get used to.
Yeah, and unfortunately here we don't have an ocean nearby to help us cool
yeah
off.
I'm not far from the ocean.
Yeah. I'm from Southern California. I feel your pain. So where did this idea for steel ponies come from?
Well, steel ponies kind of came about. We had a show here, I think it was 2 years ago, called Dazzling Pistols, Firearms. It was a firearm collection from the Autry Museum.
Right, right.
In Los Angeles, and a lot of presidential guns, Annie Oakley's pistols. And it was so popular, it really brought a whole different cross-section of people into the museum that maybe had never been there before.
Sure.
And so we kind of built on that, and we're always trying to push the envelope on people's ideas about the West or about Native America, because that's what our mission is.
Sure.
And so, you know, because of pistols and our Jingle Rails holiday train installation we do now, we've had a 40% increase in annual visitations in 2010.
Oh, my gosh.
And last year, 2011, was a record year. And, you know, not only Jingle Rails and Dazzling Firearms, but we did our Red Black show about Native American and African American connections. And that was really big. And we got a lot of people in for that.
Yeah. Cool. So I confess to some ignorance. I've never owned a motorcycle. I've ridden on them, and they're thrilling, and I marvel at the engineering of motorcycles, but I'm not aware of the connection to Native American culture. So let's start there.
Sure. Not only Native American culture, but also the West. You know, pistols was kind of like a jewelry show, Dazzling Firearms. So we thought, well, let's get some Native American theme bikes and some Western theme bikes and do the same thing. And after talking with a couple other curators, we decided, well, you know, we're about history and culture as well.
Right.
Now, the Guggenheim had done an exhibit a few years back called Art of the Motorcycle, where motorcycles were presented as art. One of the criticisms of that exhibit is it was a little sterile because there were no people involved. And, of course, what good is a motorcycle without a person riding it?
It's like going to a musical instrument exhibit. It's lovely to see a beautiful 400-year-old violin in a plexiglass case, but unless somebody can take it out and play it, you don't have its heart or its soul.
Right, exactly. So the connection with Native America, this exhibit focuses primarily on Harley-Davidson and Indian motorcycles as the only two companies that survived the 20th century. and being uniquely American. Of course, Indian uses a lot of stereotypical images to sell their products.
Sure.
They name motorcycles the Chief, the Scout. They have a Princess Sidecar. And they use all these nomenclatures and imagery. But there are Native people today that even given that, they still like Indian motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
One of our signature artists for this exhibit is Jim Yellowhawk. He's a ledger artist from South Dakota. And he rides an Indian motorcycle. There's a great picture of him in full regalia on his Indian motorcycle. So there's connections there, but also given the scope of the types of bikes that we have in the show, we're going to have the Saginaw Chippewa bike from the Chippewa tribe in Saginaw, Michigan. It was built by Orange County Choppers on the TV series American Chopper.
Really?
We have another bike called the Great Spirit that's built by a Lakota Sioux man where the tank looks like a full feathered headdress. And he has deer horn foot pegs and a drum on it. And,
oh my gosh.
It's really tricked out. And then there's a Native American bike builder in Texas. His name is Danny Sanchez. He's Apache. He's with Cutthroat Customs. And he's building us a board track racer style motorcycle that will be unveiled at the opening of the exhibit. And I just asked him. I mean, he's doing that without any commission or anything.
Oh
and
my
just
gosh.
To be involved in the project. And then Ben Nighthorse Campbell, retired senator from Colorado. Ben has been inducted in the Motorcycle Hall of Fame for his support of motorcycle riding and safety. He started the Uglies Motorcycle Club with Peter Peter Fonda and Larry Hagman. And he started the Four Corners Motorcycle Rally, which is a local run they do. And we're borrowing a motorcycle from Ben Nighthorse Campbell to be in the show, not only to show Native pride, but also because of his enthusiasm and love for motorcycle riding. So there are some strong Native American connections, especially with Jim Yellowhawk. For your listeners who aren't familiar with ledger art, when Native people were captured in the forts, they gave them pieces of paper to draw on. Sometimes those pieces of paper would be from ledger books, from account ledgers.
Uh-huh.
And they would draw, a lot of times, ponies themselves on ponies and show their war exploits. Jim Yellowhawk takes that same idea, but he puts Indians on motorcycles, and then he'll have some ponies interspersed, but he uses actual antique ledger paper.
Hmm.
And so the opening piece for the show is a Native American in full headdress on a 1948 Indian Roadmaster.
Wow.
And it's on a piece of ledger paper from 1874. And that motorcycle, that 48 Indian, will be the bike as you walk into the exhibit. The opening bike is from the Autry Museum. And it's really the epitome of Western styling and right towards the end of Indians' life as a company. And
which was when?
1953, Indian went belly up. Now, Indian had tried to been... There were people who tried to revive Indian motorcycle.
Yeah.
There was even a tribal group who was going to buy it. Now it's been bought by Polaris, and Polaris makes ATVs and other power sport products.
Motorboats and stuff.
Right. And so Polaris has taken over Indian, and they're going to be coming out with a new line of Indian motorcycles.
So for people who maybe aren't as familiar, what are the basic styles of motorcycles and or riding? You talked about board.
A board track racer, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something for everybody in this exhibit. No matter where your interest lies with motorcycles, and so in the very beginnings, motorcycles were basically bicycles with motors attached to them. The combustion engine had already been developed in Europe, and the first bicycle, if you will, with a motor was developed over there. And here, Indian motorcycle has the claim to fame of being the first motorcycle developed in this country. There was actually one before that called the Orient, but it didn't last long.
Hmm.
Indian is started by Handy and Hedstrom, who are both bicycle racers. And they take the bicycle and they put a motor on it, so it's self-propelled. And in 1902, they go into production for the public. So we actually have a 1902 Indian that
really?
We're borrowing from the Museum of American History, Smithsonian Institution.
Cool.
And, of course, to follow up with that, Harley-Davidson says that they were established in 1903. Now, full production for the public actually occurred in 1905, so we do have a 1905 Harley-Davidson as well with the 1902 Indian, and that's coming from the Harley-Davidson Museum. We have a 1915 Harley-Davidson that was ridden cross-country in 2010 on a cannonball run by Christine Summer Simmons. She's the wife of Doobie Brothers Pat Simmons, has written a book about women and early motorcycling history, and will be coming out with a book about the Cannonball Run. She'll be here July 21st to do a talk and a book signing.
That's so
but
cool.
there's vintage bikes, and then we get up into the, you can see where bikes start becoming more modern looking, like say with the 1936 Harley-Davidson Knucklehead, where the tanks, the seats, you know, the motors, the V-twin engine is really developed. And then we take that on up into the 60s, where you start getting custom choppers, and we start looking at movie bikes. So we're actually going to have the Dragon bike that Peter Fonda rode in the movie Wild Angels in 1966,
ooh,
and the Captain America bike from Easy Rider that he did in 69, the original Captain America bike.
Wow.
But there are major themes in the show. It starts off with the early brands. I do have one other brand of another motorcycle in the show, just to show that there were other brands. There were umpteen other brands.
Show the
so
contrast.
We're actually borrowing a 1914 Pierce four-cylinder motorcycle made by the Pierce Arrow Car Company.
Mm-hmm.
They made them for about a year, but they were too expensive. And it's like one of three in existence.
Whoa.
So I'm really, really excited about having that motorcycle here. There's 23 bikes in all. And it's there's touring. We're looking in 1915. Effie Hotchkiss and her mother Ava are the first women to cross the country from the East Coast to West Coast on a motorcycle with her mother Ava in a sidecar. So Christine Simmons named her bike Effie in honor of Effie Hotchkiss,
aww,
who made that run in 1915. In 1916, you had the Van Buren sisters, Adeline and Augusta Van Buren, riding cross-country on 1916 Indian motorcycles to prove to the government that that women could be dispatch riders for the military because World War I had broken out. And, of course, that never happens, but it's a great story. And we're actually going to have an actress in the gallery portraying one of the Van Buren sisters.
Cool. What do you ride?
I don't ride right now. I haven't ridden for quite a while. I used to ride a Triumph in the early days when I was younger, and I used to ride a Harley, and then I had friends that had choppers. I had a friend that had a Honda 750 four-cylinder back in the 70s, and it was the fastest bike in town. But I'm anxious to get another bike now, especially during the run of this show. We have a lot of public programming built around this exhibit. Every Saturday, or not every Saturday, but one Saturday a month through the run of the show, there's going to be a motorcycle rally at Gleaners. You know, the Gleaners Food Bank did a motorcycle rally last year. So we're teamed up with them for their rally this year. That's July 21st. The Miracle Ride that happens for the Riley's Children's Hospital, they've made the Idlejorg Museum a stop on all seven of their runs.
Oh, smart.
To come and see the exhibit, and I think we're offering discount tickets that day. And I'd like to participate in those,
well,
which means I got to get me a motorcycle.
I can tell that, you know, your excitement is more than just that of a curator. I can tell it awakened something in you.
Well, having lived in Northern California above San Francisco, as a child, I did see Hell's Angels. I had been around Hell's Angels from the San Francisco chapter, the Oakland chapter. When Easy Rider came out in 69, I was 13 years old. And it made quite an impact on me and several of my friends. And Steppenwolf Live with the, you know, Born to Be Wild was like the first album I ever bought. And so
it was destiny.
Getting that Easy Rider bike here, for me, that was the bike
what
to
a
have.
Coup. Yeah.
Because it's the most iconic bike in America. It's actually been copied more than any other bike.
Hmm.
And the owner of that motorcycle is John Parham with JMP Cycles. He runs a national motorcycle museum, and he's also loaned us a dragon bike. John was in town this weekend, and I didn't get to meet him. He wasn't feeling well, but National Motorcycle was in town. This weekend at the convention center was the big motorcycle dealer expo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have a table right now, Idle Jorg does, at the Boat, RV, and Home Show at the fairgrounds all week, promoting steel ponies. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the weekend is the motorcycle expo. We'll have a table over there, and we're actually going to have a Harley Davidson with a sidecar with the backdrop mural that people can take photos
on.
Oh,
cool.
And that will be in the gallery during the run of the show. We'll have a photo opportunity motorcycle. And we've managed, this is the first time with an exhibit in our special exhibitions gallery, where photography is going to be allowed for personal use.
Oh,
so we've
cool.
got all the lenders to agree and sign off that people can take pictures.
Oh, that's no small doing in a museum setting.
Really?
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, we wanted to do like a book or something.
Sure.
But we didn't have time, so this allows people to make a record of it. And nobody has ever had this group of motorcycles together. We're also going to have Evel Knievel's bike here.
Ooh.
Yes, the great Evel Knievel. That's also coming from the Smithsonian. And it's the bike that he wrecked on in 75 at Wembley Stadium. And I've been in touch with his artist who painted all his bikes and helmets for him. His name is George Sedlak. And I think George is coming to the opening.
Cool. Cool. Well, have fun as you put the final touches together on this. I hope one of our listeners gives you a call and says, I've got a bike you can ride.
That'd be kind of nice. I was, you know, I'm trying to buy one, but I'm having a little difficulty with that right now.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, if anybody's listening out there and wants to loan me a bike to ride, I'd really appreciate that. But, you know, April 14th is Bike Builders Day. And Danny Sanchez will be here in town. Jim Yellowhawk's going to be here on May 12th with photographer Michael Farabaugh. Michael Farabaugh has just on his own volunteered to do a ride-in motorcycle show for us on July 14th. So people, local people, can come and compete with their bikes with a $2,500 grand prize and a photo shoot for a national magazine.
Wow.
And then we got Motorcycle History Day on June 9th, and we're going to bring in Ed Youngblood, former president and CEO of AMA. It's going to be lots of fun, and I really want to encourage everyone to come out and see steel ponies. If you got a destination to ride to this year, make it the Idle Jorg Museum.
That's terrific.
Sharon Gamble with Idle Jorg curator White Wolf James. Steel Ponies is on view at the museum through August 5th. You can see all kinds of motorcycles, from vintage historical examples and famous Hollywood bikes to tricked-out custom jobs, and you can learn how they relate to both the real and imagined American West and Native America. The exhibit features the motorcycle Evel Knievel used in many of his famous jumps, the Captain American bike used in the counterculture classic film Easy Rider, and more than 20 other must-see motorcycles. Find out more and learn about lots of special programming at idlejorg.org.
Travis?
Yes, Sharon.
We have a kind of a short calendar today, so I'm going to ask you for the shortest favorite St. Patrick's Day toast you know.
Cheers! There you go.
Perfect. And we'll have more things for you to see, do, and drink on our calendar we call
What Do We Do? That's right. Happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone celebrating out there. Lots of good things to enjoy this weekend and next. Something coming up this week that's going to be a lot of fun. Wednesday, March 21st at the Palladium, From the Top with host Christopher O'Reilly is coming back to Carmel. And it's a great show heard on Sunday nights, of course, here on WFYI. And they'll be doing a live recording for future broadcast featuring some really incredibly talented local and national young musicians. Should be a lot of fun. 7:30 From the Top at the Palladium Wednesday night.
Speaking of the green, you're not going to wear the green with this next event, but you're going to learn how to make your yard and garden greener. It's the Art of Gardening on Saturday, March 24th. That's next Saturday from 9 to 4 at DeBost Lecture Hall at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. It's a workshop, a six-hour workshop, where you can beef up your gardening acumen for the coming planting season. The IMA's expert horticulturalists are doing the presentation. And whether you're a beginner or an experienced gardener, this will cover topics of interest to you. Landscape makeovers, drought survival. Boy, that's a hot topic. No pun intended lately. Smart companion planning, cutting gardens, fall perennials, pruning techniques, and as they say, much, much more. Visit imamuseum.org and make your life greener.
Very cool. Hey, something else going on at the IMA this weekend. At noon on both Saturday and Sunday, out in the nature park in 100 Acres, they are having a kite performance, a celebration of flight. Sharon, you know I love kites. I'm so excited about this.
I did not know that about you.
I do. I love kites. And so they're going to have large-scale kite performance, flags, music, and create your own kites throughout the day, rain or shine, both days at noon at the IMA.
I hope the wind cooperates.
There you go.
Hey, more than 30 large-format poetic photographic renditions, which are posters featuring the poetry and photography of John Sherman, are on display at the Indiana Interchurch Center Art Gallery, which is at 1100 West 42nd Street. That's very close to CTS. The exhibit is called Three Journeys That Redefined Lives, John Sherman, and these compilations or collaborations between the photos and the poems illustrate all sorts of fascinating experiences that John Sherman has had. And also part of the exhibit is an excerpt from the opera Biafra, which John was the librettist for.
Oh, wow.
So find out more at indianainterchurch.org.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, Diva Fest is going on this weekend and next. It's part of the Indie Fringe, and it starts Friday night, and it goes through next weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, both weekends. And it features five different plays by six different female playwrights, lots of great work, some very interesting new theater taking place. If you go to indiefringe.org, you can get the whole schedule of all the different plays when they are. Definitely worth checking out. All tickets, $10.
And you don't have to be a diva to attend.
No.
Hey, John Domon, we all know John Domon is kind of a seeker, and he is hosting something on Saturday, March 24th. That's next Saturday from 10 to 5. It's Blessing Empowerment of Medicine Buddha. What is that? It's in a special ritual ceremony and guided meditation where you're introduced to the tantric practice of a Buddha, and the event is suitable for anyone to attend regardless of previous experience. Everybody is welcome. You can find out more at meditation-indianapolis.org.
Rub the Buddha belly.
Rub the Buddha belly. There you go.
Hey, concert going on Saturday night down at the Indie Acoustic Cafe series in Fountain Square that's run by Mark Butterfield. Ellis Paul, great musician, singer, songwriter. You can check out more information at ellispaul.com and get tickets and information at indieacousticcafeseries.com. But these are great, fantastic, intimate shows worth checking out. Show on Saturday night is at 7:30 at the Wheeler Arts Theater down in Fountain Square. Very good, very good. Oh, Sharon.
Yes.
Yes. Oh, Sharon. Oh, Gamble. Sharon O'Gamble.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah. So happy St. Patty's Day, and we'll be back next week for that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Nearly 2,000 outstanding student musicians will gather in Indianapolis for the Music for All National Festival presented by Yamaha this weekend in venues around the city, including Clues Memorial Hall, Hilbert Circle Theater, and the Warren Performing Arts Center. In addition to school ensembles who've been invited to perform through an audition process, individual students were selected by audition to perform in the festival's national honor ensembles, the Honor Band of America, the Jazz Band of America, and the Honor Orchestra of America. Travis DiNicola spoke with Music for All President and CEO Eric Martin about this event.
Let's start by talking a little bit about what the Music for All organization is, because you guys do some really amazing work, and I understand you're actually going through a bit of a strategic change in how you do that work. So let's talk about that.
Yes, Travis, we're really excited about it. On March 1, the beginning of our fiscal year, we launched our new 5-year strategic plan, and the mission is still the same. Music for All's mission is to create, provide, and expand positively life-changing experiences through Music for All.
Okay.
But what's really changed at the core of this plan is our vision, which is to be a catalyst to ensure that every child has the opportunity to engage in hands-on music making during their scholastic experiences.
So it really is, when you're saying Music for All, music for all kids. I mean, I think of you, and I know many people do, as an organization that brings together great band competitions, encourages the participation in band and orchestra and jazz bands and what have you by kids. But I don't necessarily always think of you guys as an advocacy group for that sort of music education.
Yeah, you know, it's always been at the core of what we do. Mm-hmm. And our role in advocacy has always been to lead by example and to position our participants to lead by example. All of our programs include leadership models, and it's a simple leadership strategy to lead by example. However, what we've done in the strategic plan is to be just more demonstrative in terms of making sure that everyone knows that our vision is outward. It's not just to bring together the best bands, marching bands or concert bands or orchestras to perform, but actually the vision expands to try to make sure that all children have equity and access and an opportunity to engage in active music making. One of the things that's shown up over our 35-year history is that those students who have that opportunity, who actually engage and who have wonderful teachers teaching them, will perform well in anything and every endeavor that they try in life. It's
Absolutely.
Not just about producing music educators or performers. It's about producing great kids who turn into great citizens.
And this is no longer the anecdotal evidence of kids who are in band or play an instrument do well in school. This is, I mean, there's been a number of studies over the past few years, especially, that really look at the importance of music education in developing the whole student as a scholar, as a leader, as someone who's healthy. In many, many ways. So how do you envision this playing out? Will Music for All get involved in trying to influence policy in terms of funding for music education programs? Will it be even more of a resource for teachers? Or how does this play out for you?
The wonderful thing is that we can simply follow our teaching model, which is to lead by example. So we will continue to have the national showcase events that we have to bring primarily to Indianapolis and in the fall all across the country to bring the best of the best together so that they can demonstrate, so that they can be examples of what works. And I think that one of the things we observe, even when you look at commercial television, America loves a good competition.
Oh, yeah.
It loves to see people who are doing well and then to emulate or to dream about being just that. And in a real sense, we've been great at showcasing and putting and modeling examples of excellence. What we want to do is to be more intentional in our advocacy work of getting the message out there. Mm-hmm. Now, it won't be that we will do research. There was a time when Music for All, through the Music for All Foundation, did active research to get those statistics that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But in a real sense, we believe that there's enough information, both in terms of hardcore evidence and anecdotal evidence, that part is in place. But what we can do, and our effect is not really to be on specific policy, but if we just have an engaged American people who understand and witness and see by example what music and music making does for their children and for their communities, the rest will take care of itself.
Well, it sounds like a great plan. That's fantastic. And one of the best examples that I can think of is what is happening this weekend, of course. I mean, the Music for All National Festival, bringing together something like 2,000 of some of the most talented student musicians from around the country, performing here at a number of different venues, including Clues Memorial Hall, the Hilbert Circle Theater, Warren Performing Arts Center, both jazz competitions, orchestra. Tell me about what's going on this weekend, because I know it's pretty exciting for you guys.
Great. It really is exciting. We have 27 different concerts and ensembles that are going to be performing. And it's not just a collection of concert bands and jazz bands and orchestras, but really it's a bringing together the best of the best in America. So the competition occurred by mm-hmm. their auditions. They auditioned sure. for successful placement in the festival. So we will have a festival that includes the National Concert Band Festival, the Middle School National Festival. Those concerts will occur and are starting to occur Thursday through Saturday mm-hmm. at Clues Memorial Hall. And they're approximately hour-long programs that are just wonderful scholastic musicians. Then
I do want to just remind our listeners that the competition or the performances are going on right now.
Yes.
We're recording this a couple days before it all happens, but it is going on right now as you're listening to Art of the Matter. If you want to, you can log on to musicforall.org. That's music for FORALL.org, and you can get the latest schedule of all the different events that are going on. But, Eric, please keep telling us about it.
And particularly tonight, on Saturday night, there's mm-hmm. a wonderful opportunity to attend the Honor Band of America concert that will have Colonel Lowell Graham, from the U.S. Army, and also the director of bands at the University of Texas El Paso will be conducting that ensemble of over 106 musicians
wow.
who will be performing just the very best of band and modern literature. And at the same time, you could go to the concert at 7 o'clock at Hilbert, in which the Honor Orchestra of America, under the direction of Larry Livingston, will be performing the first half of the ISO subscription concert.
Right.
So it's in the city will be filled with music makers, and these are scholastic students who have become members of the ensemble by audition, mm-hmm. and they are the best of the best from across the nation. They are coming together in a unique experience that will celebrate music outwardly to our community and with the musicians as a reward for their own efforts and everything that they have done to get to where they are. They will be amongst a community of over 1,500 musicians coming together. We'll all be at Marriott Place. Mm-hmm. It's the first time we've ever had a hotel facility large enough to bring
to have all
everyone
of you
together. There will be a celebratory banquet for all of the concerts on Saturday evening before we have the culminating honor concerts at Clues and at Hilbert.
You know, and one thing that cannot be emphasized enough in terms of the importance of an event like this for the kids, for the participants, is that, you know, for them to have a couple days where they get to be around other musicians who are as talented or maybe more talented than they are, where they can hear those musicians, where they can talk to them and get to know them, kids from all over the country, that's an incredible just learning experience, developmental experience for so many of them.
That's what really makes the festival special.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, when what we hope and what we know will happen is that over 1,500 children will leave Indianapolis on Sunday far better than when they came, and the atmosphere that they will have been in, they will have been fed from a musical perspective. They
mm-hmm.
will attend master classes. They'll go to concerts and listen to others perform. The group ensembles will have a chance to hear the Arna ensembles. As I said, you know, we really focus on leadership, so they will have presentations that will deal with student advocacy and leadership and their role within the schools.
So when they go back home, they're really ambassadors.
They're ambassadors for mm-hmm. everything that can happen from music making, and in a real sense, what we really believe is that they will inspire others.
Mm-hmm.
They themselves will continue the traditions of learning that they have established for themselves, but it will simply inspire their programs to be even better.
Eric, tell me about the Jazz Band of America concert, because I know that there's something kind of a little bit new and very special going on with that this year.
Yeah, that one actually just happened last night, so
okay.
That's a Friday night concert, but it's amazing that I'm thrilled because of that John Clayton conducted that ensemble.
And who is John Clayton?
John Clayton is a Grammy Award winner. If you're a real serious jazzer, you will know and see his name on so many different ensembles. But the thing that sort of is amazing, and one of the things I try to express to the kids who have come here, whether they're in a jazz band or not, is that they're part of history.
Mm-hmm.
And in a real sense that this is for not always the best reasons, this is a special year. But John Clayton was the person who composed the arrangement of the Star Spangled Banner that Whitney Houston sang at the Super
wow.
Bowl.
Okay.
So when you look at the power of music making and the indelible memories that it can instill upon people. Mm-hmm. For these young men and women to have the opportunity to come and work with artists and teachers like that, that's why we exist at Music for All. We create special moments and then try to engage our students so that they will take home lasting memories, mm-hmm. but also be persons who will inspire memories in the future, no matter what their field of study may be.
Well, and so much of learning in the arts occurs through that sort of legacy and that tradition of one teacher who's worked with somebody else who's then teaching the next generation and passing that on. I mean, you know, that sort of learning that takes place in whether it's in music or dance, you really can't get anywhere else. You have to experience through that one-on-one mentoring and tutoring and through that in-class participation. It's really just a great experience.
It really is. And Music for All as an organization was inspired by a teacher, Larry McCormick, created Bands of America, trying to recreate and to create the opportunities for children to have the wonderful type of experiences that he had with teachers who he credits with getting him through high school and getting him on to his business start. So in a real sense, what we really believe is that any child who has an opportunity to be engaged in ensemble experiences with great teachers, they're just going to be better prepared. Sometimes I like to anecdotally say, could you imagine what our nation would be like, what the Congress would be like if all of the members of Congress knew what it meant to be an ensemble,
mm-hmm.
or to know when they need to lead, uh-huh. when they need to follow, to be able to listen to others and to communicate, and to know that at the end of the day, unless the ensemble is effective, the whole program has been ineffective.
No, that's a great analogy. Absolutely. Hey, before I let you go, I know that there's many sponsors that help put this together, but certainly a big shout out to Yamaha. They've been a great sponsor for many years for you.
Yamaha Corporation of America really makes a difference at Music for All, and they, along with our many, many other corporate sponsors, including Remo, Vic Firth, and so many others in the music industry, and I certainly have to mention the support of the Arts Council and other foundations in our city that have been supportive of Music for All and its programming. They really make the difference, and those are folks who've invested and know the power of music making and are trying to do everything they can to ensure that we have a future in terms of music education in our nation.
Travis DiNicola with Music for All President and CEO Eric Martin. The Music for All National Festival is going on throughout the city this weekend. Check their website, musicforall.org, for the latest schedule of events. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4, when I'll get a preview of Dance Kaleidoscope's upcoming Shakespearean performance.
I'll get a preview of the Creative Spaces Rural Places Road Trip Art Tour.
And I'll talk with some dancers who are working with patients who have Parkinson's. Plus, there'll be our arts counter we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.